instructions, then they don't have to worry about crypto much. I'm wondering how many of those their people are working for small wall or open sense on their days off. But then again, PF Sense was bought up by a company, so it may be an Oracle style move.
Oh, maybe.
You buy our hardware, we put the instructions. We put Intel, modern Intel chips in it. They got the instructions. We don't care about you trying to do homebrew your shit.
Right.
Well, I just bought a new box for PF Sense that will probably be running OpenSense in. It's going to be a pain to change over, but I can't see buying a new box just to get a few instructions.
Right. Hey, 50. Hey, just so you know, we talked about the Google Home Cardboard thing last week.
Oh, okay.
Well, I may have some good news health-wise. Sometime in the next few months, I'm going to be tested for sleep apnea.
If that's what's going on, that'll be something be good to get taken care of.
Well, I finally got an MD shrink who I raised the question, and he's going to we're following up with a sleep specialist.
Because they increased the pressure on mine, and the smaller mask that I picked out originally just, it won't handle the pressure, and there's no point because I got to hold, the only way that I can keep it sealed is to hold my face in a certain position, which I can't do while I'm sleeping. So I approached the local supply company about a new mask. They said, well, insurance probably won't cover it. So, well, it can't be that much. I'll just pay for it. I finally called them again last week, and they said, yeah, they never called me back. I was doing all that traveling, but they're in long story short, I got to pay for it, and jumping to get in there all this week, then get in. So it'll be next. Unless I get in there tomorrow, it'll be next week. But I really need this different mask for it to work for me, because just the last couple weeks, it's really been catching up with me. It's like I'm not sleeping at all.
Yeah, well, I've had sleep troubles for decades, and finally, we're going to get it looked at. Also, I'm going to get a test at home, at least for the data collection part. Of course, the setup has to be done in a lab.
Yeah, see, that's the trouble. The home test just tells them that you need to have the test in the clinic or hospital. Those are expensive, and I've actually been in for those three times now. So they eventually got it right.
Well, the deal is that I'm being treated for anxiety and other things, and I'm pretty sure my anxiety would show up in the lab. I'm not sure my sleep would.
Well, they told me, like, I was, waking up, like, 90 times an hour, which is more than once a minute. So, I don't know how I was getting any kind of sleep at all, but...
Well, they were telling me that the wake-up never really gets to your head. It just... your body just cycles through its emergency ventilation system.
So is it just three of us tonight, or are we waiting to see?
It may just be the three of us. Did we have any email feedback that anybody remembered?
Yeah, I got one. I still have an answer from... No, that was on HPR. Sorry, never mind.
Did you read the article about the security flaw and the Ubuntu login screen that Kay Wisher put on the G+ site?
No, that's something we could probably talk about.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't read it either.
I wonder if it expects... if it is a problem with Debian. Although Debian, as far as I can tell, doesn't have a guest login by default. If the weather gets hot like it's been, I may be podcasting from the cellar. later this summer.
That's where I'm at.
I mean, it was like 83 in here yesterday, and that wasn't the warmest day.
Well, 83 would be a cold day in the Kansas summer.
Well, that's at night, but anyway. Yeah. Yeah, I know out there.
What's the current version of Ubuntu?
14.04.
I don't think that's right.
Yeah, that's the latest state or long term.
No, it's not the latest long term. Latest long term is 16.04.
Because this is talking about an issue with LightDM and Ubuntu version 17.04 and 16.10. And it wanted to blame the switch from Upstart to Systemd as being part of the problem. But I thought that was like recent that they, you know, got rid of Upstart and did Systemd, or if they have even, if that's even gone into, has that even gone into a system yet? Because I thought all those switches, removing Upstart, removing Unity, and everything else was all going into 18.04, or whatever the latest version is, that hasn't like fully gone in yet. At least that was, I didn't know that Systemd went into Ubuntu in 16.10 or 17.04.
Well, that's what they were saying, although it may have been the rev of Systemd that came in at 16.10 and 17.04. My Debian Sparky Linux is running Systemd, but I don't think I have the bug.
Well, using LightDM?
I don't know what my manager is here. How would I find that out?
It's a good question. I'm sure there's an easy way to find it out. I'm just not sure what that is. Would it show when you try to switch, when you log out and try to switch users? Or is there a way to look it up that way?
I may do Google Foo.
Either way, this says that it's already been patched. So, and all it does is allow it. The exploit was just that if someone who has a physical access to your laptop, if they log out, they can get access to other people's files. Something through an exploit on with LightDM. It doesn't go into the exploit itself. It just explains that there was a problem with LightDM, and they thought it was something to do with the switch between Systemd from Upstart.
Yeah, according to Ask Ubuntu, if you have a WMCTRL installed, then if you do WMCTRL /M, that will tell you the Windows manager.
Well, I think I just...
Run that by me again?
Yeah, the command is WMCTRL, which is probably not installed by default, so... but if you install it, then it's WMCTRL /M.
I think I screwed up and talked about our one and only feedback but the pre-show that it was supposed to happen during the show. All right, do we want to start the show now?
Yeah, I don't think anybody else is going to come.
No, I don't think so either. So the question is, who wants to host? I still think, NetMiner, you should just be the voice of Linux Slugcast. You should just be the host.
I'm an Indian, not a chief. Sorry. What package would that be in?
Well, I'm installing it on SUSE right now. I just did sudo zyper install wmcontrol. It seems to be doing it. It's still working through the repositories right now.
Well, I have no joy.
I added it to the bottom of my show notes. It's from the page I looked at was on Ask Ubuntu, so it ought to work for you.
All right, so we're ready to start?
I am. And my desktop is IceWM. Apparently that is the Windows manager, because I ran that command and it says not applicable in A.
Huh. What are you running the IceWM on?
OpenSUSE, and the only reason I'm running it is, I've mentioned this on the show before, when I installed OpenSUSE, I was running KDE, and one day suddenly KDE wouldn't load, so the only other installed desktop environment was IceWM, and really it works pretty well for everything. There's just some stuff in the GNOME repositories don't work. I can't use gparted on it for some reason. But other than that, everything else seems to work.
See, if I couldn't get gparted to work, I don't think I would use the machine.
Well, I have used other machines, and then I've become fairly familiar with FDisk. And you know this, and still, I need to swap the power supply in my tower and get back on it. It's not doing anything yet. But one of the fans is making a racket, and that, you know, that means all of a sudden it's going to stop and it's going to burn. You know, not with heat, but throwing off voltage and stuff. It's liable to burn something else at. So I didn't want to take any chance on it.
See, I've been able to use FDisk before, and I have pretty good knowledge of how to use FDisk, but I am so much more comfortable with gparted, and I use it often.
Well, yeah, FDisk, I look at everything really, really hard before I tell it to actually commit something. Well, same thing with gparted, but yeah, gparted is a lot easier to use.
Welcome to Linux Slugcast, episode 79. We are an open podcast slug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxslugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Slugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode, pound Linux Slugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxslugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mailing list. Visit our website for the direct links. We're sorry tonight there is no stream, but I guess people would know that by now. So with us tonight, I am Hunky Magoo, and with us is 5150.
Howdy, folks.
And Netminer.
Hello.
So our one piece of feedback was from Kevin Wisher, posted in our G Plus community, a security flaw in Ubuntu login screen. We went through a good amount of detail of this in the pre-show, so, but we are gonna. I just wanted to touch on it quickly. Apparently, there's a flaw in LightDM in Ubuntu versions 17.04 and 16.10. They suspect, at least in this article, they suspect that the reason was the switch from Upstart to Systemd. Basically, it's already been patched, and but from what I can tell, it's people who have physical access to your machine through LightDM can have access to the rest of the machine. So, but like I said, it's already been patched. So if you have 17.04 or 16.10 and are running LightDM, please update your systems. And what was the thing to run to tell what your DM is?
Well, and I was able to install it on OpenSUSE. I got it from an Ask Ubuntu link, and it's wmctrl --m should tell you your Windows manager.
Never mind. Did you get that installed?
I got it installed. I'm running XFCE, so it's XFCE's window manager, which is not LightDM.
That seems odd. I've used XFCE before and still had LightDM. I didn't know XFCE had its own window manager.
Yeah, it seems like a good part of the time LightDM is your window manager. I think there's also GNOME has its own window manager, but you know, it's usually one of the two.
Well, I have here XF Wyndham WM4.
Sorry, I just, I know I have, on one of my systems, the, I know I have, LightDM installed. So it says window manager is showing the desktop mode NA. Not sure that works right then. Shows name enlightenment, class comp, PID NA, window manager showing the desktop mode NA. Window manager showing the desktop in quotations, and then mode NA. That's weird. Anyways, 5150, you have a plethora of topics tonight?
Yeah, I do. Not really a Linux topic other than do we want to talk about WannaCry at all?
Sure.
Okay, and I need to probably open up that article and look at it. You know, this has been going around. You probably heard about it on the news. If your Windows system is up to date, this should not affect you. But I guess this is works through a vulnerability in Samba, and if one person on a network gets infected, and I guess you get infected through an email phishing attack, and it gets out there in the wild on the network, then any other vulnerable computers on the network can get infected, and this is taken well. You know, most of us know you go to hospital, all of them are still running Windows XP. And there is a patch out there. If you're this came down hard enough that Microsoft actually released an XP patch to fix this. But I don't think, you know, I doubt if Windows Update is still running at all. So for XP. So you have to go manually find the patch and put it on. And this thing's still bouncing around the internet. So if you've got a potentially vulnerable machine, definitely make sure you go out there and get it patched. This thing is taking down whole hospitals because most of your diagnostic machines, all the computer in every room and every operating room and whatever, pretty much all running XP. Because they think they're on a closed system, and then, you know, somebody in the hospital gets it, and they all get it.
So what does it do? It's another encryption?
It's another ransomware. Looks for all your documents and encrypts them, and tells you if you have, like, 30 hours or something to send them $100 in Bitcoin, I think it was, and if you don't, then after that it doubles, and then after that, the heck with you, and you won't ever get your files back. Of course, authorities are saying, you know, don't give in to terrorists or whatever. So, you know, definitely the other thing to say is, you know, have everything backed up.
Right.
Yeah, but it's especially hard on, you know, places like hospitals and, you know, places where they have some sort of integrate special software that has to be run on every, you know, not desktop Windows, but just, something where you know, they have their own special software running on top of Windows that runs, you know, runs at every workstation. And like I said, a lot of that stuff is still running on XP because those companies are real, you know, well, you buy the computer and, you know, if you want to upgrade to a later version of Windows, pretty much the only choice is to go buy all your, buy the system all over again. And, you know, when they're paying thousands, thousands of dollars, they're usually loath to do that. Maybe this will get them prompted to actually take it seriously and get the upgrade.
Another group that should be incredibly vulnerable to this are libraries.
Right, I think that's one of the things mentioned in the article. And, it's a Wired article, and you look at it for about 3 minutes, and then they show up with, like, hey, you should really be paying us for this content. So, like I said, it's not a Linux issue. I'm sure everybody out there from the range of my voices is aware of it. We've already done the best thing we can to protect ourselves from this kind of attack by not running Windows. Okay, this is the first Friday evening in 3 weeks that I've been home. I announced at the last show I was on that I was going to attend several Linux Fests. 3 weeks in a row. PenguinCon, Linux Fest Northwest, and last weekend Kansas Linux Fest. It was, you know, right here in my state, about 70 miles away in Wichita. So first, you know, bring up PenguinCon, which I've discussed before. The main draw this year was Cory Doctorow, and he did two or three sessions. I caught the last one he did on essentially promoting his new book, which is Walk Away. Apparently, everybody that was there for his keynote the afternoon before got free hard copies, and a lot of people were in line to get those autographed from him. But also there's a digital, an audiobook version was available there at the conference at a significant discount in the form of a credit card sized USB key, you know, sort of flipped out from the side. And now the one thing that he started with really in his presentation was this time he was not able to release the book as Creative Commons because he had trouble finding a publisher that understood the whole yes, it's free to be copied deal. Not surprising, they want to make their money out of it. So, and that brings up the question, if I wanted to copy the file from the USB key onto my computer and then further onto a portable audio device, is that a violation of copyright because I'm making personal copies of it? I wanted to ask him about that and sort of introduce myself. Never got the chance, because, you know, he did allocate the time right after he, finished his talk to having the book signed. And there were a bunch of people in line for that. So I really couldn't just break in the line, start talking to him. And then he must have left right after that. So. Got to see Cory Doctorow, did not get a chance to introduce myself or meet him. If you don't recall, PenguinCon is this combination of Linux Technical Conference and Sci-Fi Con with, you know, a bunch of other stuff thrown in. You know, a lot of stuff on food and cooking and etc. If you want to get an idea what PenCon is all about, the site schedule.penguincon.org is still up, and there's rather, you know, you see it's rather eclectic you know, range of subjects to go in a session on. As far as the sci-fi conference, there is the usual cosplay. Other than that, a lot of the stuff is more on, you know, how to write your own sci-fi. And I haven't been to any other conference. I mean, it's not like you've got George Takei showing up and doing a panel or something. You do have authors, sci-fi authors show up and do sessions on how to write, how to do character development, you know, all kinds of that stuff. There were a lot of sessions on cosplay, how to make your costume, how, you know, what materials to use, this and that. There always has been down in the hotel lobby a bunch of tables set up for, tabletop gaming of one type or another, just about anything you can think of. And they're usually going all day. So if you are a fan of tabletop gaming, you can probably find your game and jump into it. This year's the first time I've actually seen those on the schedule. You know, pretty much every game that's represented is there on the schedule at some point. So I think if you were to attend that, they would explain the rules and all that to you. I didn't attend any of those, but I'm assuming that's what that is about. There is, this year they had the Artemis Bridge Simulator. There was another one they had last year. Artemis is, I believe, Windows based, but essentially you're simulating the bridge of the Enterprise, even though you're not sending royalties to Paramount. So you have a navigator position, and you have a helm position. You have a communications position. The only time I got in on a couple of years ago was to do that, and really, other than signaling that you're coming into a star base. They said, you know, the one protagonist we were up against said, well, they'll make mistakes if you constantly harass them on the radio. So there's a list of commands. You said, you know, so you can pick something like your father was a hamster and your mother smelled of elderberries, and send that message to them. So that's, you know, that's sort of the most throwaway position on the whole thing. You know, engineer position, whatever. So that's fun. That's fun to get a bunch of people in the room and do that. And the guy that does it comes in, you know, he has a bunch of small PC, not like laptops, but they are small form factor PCs that he carries around just to do this, and sets up a network. And you can do it, you know, you could do it against another crew in another room somewhere if you wanted to, but if not, there is a, a single team version where you're up against computer generated opponents. And of course the captain's position really doesn't get any computer control, because he's supposed to be getting the input from everybody and then making the decisions and telling them what to do. So in the perfect world, you'd have a big monitor on the wall, just like you do at the Enterprise, and that would be what the captain would look at. But he wouldn't have any physical controls in front of him. That's the way it's supposed to be set up. And I want to go, and that's probably explaining way too much about one aspect of PenguinCon. Other things that were, you know, part of PenguinCon, it's $20 a day, including Friday. I got there late enough, they didn't charge me for Friday. In fact, I was worried about getting in early enough that they wouldn't be shut down, because it wouldn't matter if the sessions, if registration was closed, but if you don't have a badge, you can't get into the room parties. And Friday and Saturday night, you have these epic room parties up on usually the fourth and fifth floor of, oh, I'll look it up, the hotel there in Detroit. Well, it's a suburb of Detroit. Well, essentially you're in Detroit, but I'll get that in a minute. But, you know, these room parties are, you know, a lot of them, they have a DJ going and the music loud enough to rearrange your internal organs. I'm not sure somebody my age should be going in a room like that. But you can imagine if you've ever been to something like OLF where you're having a quiet conversation with half a dozen people in a room and the manager shows up and says, you guys need to quiet down. You can imagine the contrast where, you know, everybody's, you have three or four rooms down a hallway and everybody's is pounding 80s power ballads until 2 o'clock or two. Yeah, probably about 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe three. And of course there's alcohol and there's usually a place to, usually contribution box, but nobody's charging a cover or anything, to get in. Also PennCon itself, they have usually have three kegs of craft beer running all evening. You have the, of course the epic, liquid nitrogen created ice cream, which on Friday and Saturday nights, usually includes an alcohol component. And they're, you know, they're, it, and that's all centered around the hospitality lounge, and that will have Coke and junk food and healthy food if you want. fruits, you know, fruit and stuff. And then around mealtime, they'll usually bring out like a selection of cold cuts. You can make a sandwich, you know, at lunch and dinner time. So really, you know, that $20 a day would be all, that and your accommodations would be all that you would need to spend. So I'll let off for comments here if there's anybody wants to talk about it. Swift 110 says the stream is on. Okay. And any of you guys,
sorry, Father Finch just dropped in real quick and set up the stream.
Okay, great. And yeah, okay, I see that there. And anybody in the IRC, this, you know, this is a lug. You guys are more than willing to jump into the mumble with us. It's not just supposed to be you know, the quote regular host talking. All you guys are more than welcome to participate. So yeah, if you go to Linux Fest at all, or if you're all interested in that, you know, and if you like to party a little, definitely. PenguinCon is different than any other Linux Fest that I've been to, or I think that anybody's been to, and you owe it to yourself to go at least once.
I'd love to be able to go. That sounds like so much fun. I think I'd be sitting there trying to figure out what between just out of pure curiosity, the cosplay and sci-fi type stuff, and then the food and the tech stuff. I'd have a hard time choosing what to go see.
Oh yeah, yeah. Now, I found less tech stuff that I was interested in going to this year. I did bounce that off Kevin O'Brien. He said, "Well, we've got, you know, just as many tech oriented talks as ever." I don't know. You know, there are some that were less directly Linux, or some that were more enterprise and beyond my needs. But I found myself this year gravitating more towards a lot of the food related stuff. There's more than enough of that to, you know, but definitely there's, you know, there's always something going on to occupy yourself with, and people just set up ad hoc things down in the lobby. I didn't see it till I was about walking out the door, but you know, and if I'd known my flight was going to be delayed 2 hours like it was, I would have stayed and played with it. But a guy said, you know, had a machine running Steam, you know, a powerful gaming PC with the reality goggles that you put on, you know, virtual reality goggles.
Was it Oculus and or?
I don't think it was Oculus. I'm not sure. But you know, but he had games, you know, virtual reality game running, and he was letting people get in and check it out. So that was cool. Like I said, I had time to stand there and watch other people do it, because they had a monitor up, of course, and you could see what they were doing. But I didn't feel at the time I had time to participate. And like I said, if I'd known my flight was going to be delayed, I would have. But that's another nightmare. If you heard, I don't know if anybody heard me on Tilts last week when I was promoting Kansas Linux Fest. I'll try to make it a little shorter. But essentially, the plane we were supposed to leave on at 6 o'clock was delayed for quote maintenance till about 8, and then 8 became 11 or 10, and then 10 became midnight. And they kept telling us, no, it'll take off once we get it fixed. And then they said, that plane, it has to go, wasn't Seattle, somewhere far out west. Once it goes there and comes back, it'll pick you guys up. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Because this was after midnight. And, you know, they were giving us doublespeak. You know, a bunch, and because what the people came in and people to death said, yeah, it hasn't taken off yet to go out west, and then the guy, supervisor type guy or acting as one, came by and says, no, it left 90 minutes ago. It'll be here by before morning. And there was another flight out I guess this is with the Chicago O'Hare. Okay. Yeah, so this was the middle, this wasn't the first flight out, but you know, saying it'll leave before the next flight in the morning, because a lot of people say, well, just, you know, schedule us on that next flight. But eventually they relented about 2 o'clock. They started bringing out all the plane snacks and stuff to you know, so we didn't, you know, keep us happy. I was going up to fill my pockets with more, and I was behind the pushy lady who'd been on them all night, and she just said, you know, just tell us the truth and let us go someplace and sleep, because there are actually cots in O'Hare. That we walked past, and it was only about 5 minutes to the hotel. So I opted, you know, once we got us on the next flight in the morning, go to the hotel. Of course, this was after 2 a.m. and we figured we need to be back by 5, you know, for a 7 o'clock flight out. So there wasn't much, you know, time for sleep. Got some. Turns out that flight didn't leave till like 9, and they didn't tell us. We could have had a decent sleep. And the reason was crew rest. Yeah, we didn't get in till late, so you know they make us sleep. Well, fine, you know that's the you know, great. Why don't you tell let the passengers get some sleep too? But so yeah, I probably gone on as long as I did on tilt. So yeah, I did not have a fun experience with American on my way back. And they're also 2 hours late taking off on Friday. There are sessions from 4 o'clock to about 10 o'clock on Friday. I think the flight that I got out would have got me there about 6, which is about as early as I would have been able to get there other than coming Thursday night and another night in the hotel. So I did just miss the whiskey tasting, which I'm sorry that I did. And that's another thing. A lot of the sessions on the schedule you want to look at closely, because you know the host or whatever, they have limited resources. They don't want to buy whiskey for everybody that's there. So, or food or whatever, you know, anything that deals with consumable, you're probably going to want. There's probably going to be a sign up list to get on at registration. So, you know, keep that in mind. If you just show up, well, you know, I did just show up for the port tasting and said, well, there's a sign up list, but not everybody signed up is here. So I was able to just squeak in on that one. And that was very interesting. So yeah, I'll let up for questions or comments. Okay. I did bring the schedule up. Before we jump off of PingCon, let me look through the schedule for the for maybe some of the highlights that I saw. Just a second here. It's not finding the tab. Like I said, a lot of stuff. Okay, here comes the schedule. Like I said, I missed everything on Friday, but I did get into the room parties. That's cool. You know, I said I was afraid I was going to get there and the registration be closed, but actually they were closing up registration, but they moved it over to the main information desk. So, you know, they're really good. They were still registering people as late as about 1 o'clock in the morning, from what I could tell. And I'm on the page, but the actual, that's weird. The actual session stuff is not coming up. And I've had this open already this evening. Okay, that's probably enough time to spend on PagansCon. But yeah, definitely go to PagansCon sometime. Second one was Linux Fest Northwest. And admittedly, one of the reasons I've gone there the last 2 years is because Dore and Cody Cooper and the Podnuts crowd, well, they were there last year, and I found out after registering everything this year that they weren't going. My fault for making assumptions or not keeping up on Podnuts broadcast, but still, I'm glad I went. Well, I'm really glad I went because I put a dollar in on a raffle and got a Acer Intel powered Chromebook. So definitely a win there. And we'll get to that. But, you know, Linux Fest Northwest is much more of a conventional Linux Fest. It's on the College of the Technical College there in Bellingham. Thing is, Bellingham, Washington is you know, if you took two steps to the, well, I said this the last show I was on. If you took two steps to the west, you would be in the Pacific Ocean, and two steps to the north, you'd be in Canada. So the whole trouble for everybody with Bellingham is that you cannot get there from here. And yeah, the flights at the Bellingham itself, I mean, like last year, yeah, you could get a connecting flight in the Bellingham, but it was, you know, 7 hour wait between Seattle, you know, at Seattle before going on the Bellingham. So your best bet is going to be fly into Seattle and rent a car. I guess you could Uber, but, you know, there were things to do and see, and I wanted to have a meal in Seattle on the way back. That's the other trouble. The flights out of Seattle are such that either I would have to leave in the middle of the afternoon on Sunday for the conference while things were still going on, or, you know, fly out at 11 o'clock at night and not get back to Wichita until 10 o'clock the next morning, then an hour's drive to get home. So, yeah, it's not a real easy place to get in and out of. It, you know, that two-hour drive between Seattle and Bellingham is incredible, because you're going all along the coast. Well, down towards Seattle, you're more along the coast, so you really don't see out into the ocean, because there's a bunch of barrier islands around that part. So, you know, you don't really see out into the open ocean. But, you know, Seattle is definitely a seaport. So there's a bunch of stuff, you know, a lot of great scenery, and it's weird. You see the sea on one side, and you look the other direction, you've got snow-capped mountains. So it is just a beautiful, beautiful area to visit. And, you know, and that drive is worth it just for the drive. Though I will say, most of those flights end on Friday. They get you there around rush hour. And, you know, mine got in late this year, but it would have been at the same time if it'd been there on time. But, yeah, if you head north out of Seattle about 5 o'clock, tell you what, if it's open, go see the Space Needle, get dinner. I've been wanting there's a Boeing museum up there in Seattle, but it's not really open on weekends. One day when I go that direction, I'm going to see it. But, yeah, it's just, you know, you head north out of Seattle, and there's just a couple suburbs up there, and traffic slows to 10, 15 miles an hour for miles and miles and miles and miles. So you're a lot better off. You know, I said, is there late anyway? Ate dinner in the evening. Before I left Seattle. So it was well after dark before I started my drive up there. And at least there's traffic all the way, but at least none of it was below highway speed. And there is a Friday night event. I was there for some of it last year. I was really really under the impression, even though everybody it said that everybody is invited, it seemed like mainly it was the organizers and the Jupiter Broadcasting Linux guys. They're a big part, you know. They take a really big part in setting things up and all that. So they were there. I didn't know who they were when I was talking to them, really, but I learned later who they were 2 years ago. But this year, yeah, it was still going on, but it just wasn't much point. One of the problems is there's no hotels anywhere near the technical college. And last year I was in, I think, Holiday Inn, and it was next to the, it was next to this really cool brew pub. And, I think Doran, his guys were in the Ramada, or maybe I was in the Ramada, they were in the Holiday Inn. But Roy, they're both, you know, opposite ends of the same block. And in the middle was this, you know, really nice brew pub, but none of it anywhere close to the technical college. But I, this year I went with the hotel that, and the discount that was, listed on the, Northwest Linux Fest page for accommodations. And it's, that hotel is one that hosts the, Saturday night after party, which, you know, as opposed to after parties that you may have gone to, like OLF, this had local craft beer on tap. So that's another plus. Otherwise, a lot like the OLF after party, but Brian Lundu, you know, is the big draw for Northwest Linux Fest, and he's doing his usual antics, and like a, you know, they had tables, split into teams and doing trivia, sort of a trivia thing. I got in there late because somebody had given me the idea, hey, you need to go around and collect some, to all these local brew pubs that they have up there and collect growlers. Or, well, actually breweries, you know, there are several pubs up there that have their own brewery, because this is right in the middle of hops growing country. So, you know, next year I'll probably pick up maybe some from Seattle, either going in or coming out. Cause, you know, of course there's all kinds of brew pubs in Seattle. And there's at least half a dozen there in Bellingham. And I got most of them. I didn't go to my favorite one because I knew they were hosting the, they would be serving the beer at the after party. So, I'll have their beer. But, you know, other than that, the speakers, really in some ways, it's better organized than the OLF. Your tag that you get. It has a printed copy of the schedule, and so it flips up, you know, it's on there upside down. So when you flip it up towards you, you can read it. And, so that's a real easy way to, you know, rather than going online or do it, something like that, you've got the schedule right there in front of you. They have the students from the college, volunteer, and every session has one or two students out there, you know, there as runners to take care of stuff. Every session is filmed. In fact, actually broadcast on YouTube, in real time. So, you know, if you missed the conference, every session from the conference should be up there. Probably link already on the webpage. And there were some really interesting things. One of the more different ones, there were these guys that sell like telemetry stuff. You could call it model rocketry, but this is not Estes type model rocketry. These are home built rockets that reach Mach 3 and go to 200,000 feet. So this is something, you know, when they have a day to set these off, they have to, you know, have the FAA set, you know, set off a section of airspace for them. And I found out there is one that they do, you know, in Kansas every year. So got that date on my calendar because, it's not a hobby I'm likely to ever get into, but it'd be cool to go there and see it once. These guys were designing their own components, but it's a lot like single board computer type stuff, but telemetry that would track the speed and altitude that the rocket went to, and, you know, real time readout so they could see the performance, you know, because they're building their own rockets and, you know, that they need the feedback. Also, it broadcasts. A lot of them, you have to have the ham radio, amateur radio license, because at least on, I think they broadcast some of the telemetry while they're in flight, but mainly to make it easier to locate the where the rocket came down, so you can drive right to it and pick it up. So that was a real interesting talk that is outside most of my experience, I think, but it may be interesting to any geek. If there was any complaint I would make, probably sometimes the Linux stuff, you usually had, well, no, you had more than three running, but a lot of times across there, stuff I'd be interested in, but every one of them was more enterprise. And if they could have made it so there was not, a non-enterprise thing in every hour, that would have made it easier to pick what I wanted to see. They do provide dinner. I mean, well, if you don't have to pay them anything to get it. It's a free conference. If you do the $100 sponsorship thing, and which I did, because if I figure if I can afford, get on an airplane, rent a car, and book a hotel, I can afford to give the conference $100. That gets you a t-shirt and two lunches at the cafeteria, which is better than it was last year. If I and last year when I was paying for it out of pocket, I thought it was kind of overpriced it. It's like $13 for a dorm lunch. But this year I think they did a little better. Last year you'd had to squint to find the meat in anything, a bunch of casserole type dishes, oriental type stuff, and I didn't wasn't all that good. But this year you could either have, I think they did a lot better with their food, still mainly stirred up casserole type stuff. And pizza, kind of Domino's pizza, not great pizza, not a lot of stuff on the pizza, but it was pizza, in the normal dinner. Or you could have a steak. And amazingly, they cooked the steak about by default the way I like steak, which is, pass it in front of the fire real quick and take it back. I mean, this was a bloody rare steak. Unfortunately, it was painfully obvious that it was grass fed. But that, this is peripheral, so probably you're gonna want to eat on campus. About 45 minutes for lunch. Not really enough time to get away too far. Like last year I did. Somebody said, well, that I met said you go downtown at what this brew pub and eat. So I did. And unfortunately, I missed most of Brian Lunduke's talk. So, but yeah, and go. Well, links in the show notes. Go to the schedule page. You can see this one. Again, you can see the sort of things that were available for the conference. Any comments, questions? Anybody still alive? Okay, then finally, at least for my Fest news, is Kansas Linux Fest, which you can find at kansaslinuxfest.org. This last 2 years, it has been hosted by Wichita State University and organized by the local maker and developer groups there, I guess. After 2 years, they seem to be getting a little burned out. It may move back to Lawrence next year, if they can work out a deal with the University of Kansas. So So this is for, about only about an hour's drive for me. I did stay in town because, after party and stuff. I stayed there in Wichita. And they scored really big this year. And I didn't know it till about a week before the conference. Looking through the schedule, John Mad Dog Hall.
And what was this talk about?
Let's see. He did one on picking the right mini PC. Let me bring the page up. Did kind of a history sort of thing. Of course, he's been around for everything. And one of the other speakers was, and I didn't associate with it till heard from him on G+, Bob Murphy. It's Murph. I don't know if you guys have ever met him. Taj has, of course. So, Saturday night after party, here I am sitting across from Murph and next to Mad Dog. So, you can imagine that's a pretty good time. And Friday night, they have a movie night. They did the, screening of The Internet's Own Boy, which you can download off of, archive.org. And of course, that's the story of Aaron Schwartz, a documentary. So, you ought to go, anybody listening ought to go to archive.org and download and watch that. Let's see. The benefits and responsibilities of business to free software. Unfortunately, I missed that one. I guess the only other one was, like I said before, choosing a single board computer. So he's talking about Raspberry Pis and Odroids, and I guess he's in development of one for sort of the third world down in Brazil. I don't think it's available up here. Other things, Spencer Hundley talked about encryption security. Ain't no party like a ASAN KC crypto party. I guess ASAN is an association for people who are, I don't know why my brain cannot remember. I know the word, I just can not. Autistic, yes. Wow. So I know. Let's see. Sudo, why you're doing it wrong. That was up against Spencer, so I didn't get to see it. Lumina, I would like to have seen that one. I guess I can get back after. Yeah, I was probably up too late the night before. Well, I was up late night before playing. No, that wasn't that. It was wrong weekend. I was just up too late. I was up too late going around Old Town after the movie. No, that wasn't it. I was up too late. After the after party, I was up too late hanging around Old Town. Old Town is this built up sort of entertainment arty type district that they did to say, sort of save downtown, do something productive with it. I stayed in the hotel that's in the old Keen Cutter factory building, which was kind of cool. So, you probably all seen these made up improvement districts, so that kind of area, and I got a hotel there, so I wouldn't have to Uber back from the bars or anything. see. Oh, yeah, and I met Mike Lucas. He was the first speaker they booked. And really the reason why, when they found out that it was same weekend as Mother's Day, if they couldn't move, is because Mike had already booked his flight. He's a technical author, more BSD than a Linux guy, apparently. but has several books out there on network administration. I think I put a link to his Amazon page in the show notes. Well, I know I did. And he's also done some fiction, some science fiction. His local book, last book is a, the last fiction book is a murder mystery set at a professional BSD conference. So not quite a Linux Fest, but something sort of like that, but more of a pro conference. And the title of it is Git Commit Murder. And I'm a few pages into it, and it's pretty good so far. So definitely, if you're looking for technical instruction or maybe some recreational reading, follow that link in the show notes. Let's see, Introduction to Python was on one of them, which I went to, and not much in the coding of Python, a lot on tools to use to code Python. Of course, Murphy did his talk on screen that he's been doing the last few years. He's saying that he's going to move on to doing something else. Everybody's heard it. let's see. One on Git called I Don't Get It. One on TrueOS. That was up against Mad Dog's talk. So that used to be what used to be FreeBSD, I think. And I've talked about that. That's the one I've been having trouble installing on my tower, because it's not filling out the partitions that I've created for it. And I did figure out what I was doing wrong on there. And apparently I'm not the first one to do this. It's just, it's going to create ZFS partitions no matter what you have, but you have to create a partition for it. But you create a partition that's going to use all the space that you're going to allocate to it. And then it will, TrueOS will actually, you know, create the root, the home, the swap, and all that stuff. It'll create separate partitions. But that was the trouble. I was trying, you know, I was creating a root and a home. And then when it, you know, when TrueOS installed, it threw everything into that root and nothing into the other partitions that I created for it. But you have to have, because I tried with just blank space, that did work. And I tried with creating partitions. So you only want one partition, and then TrueOS will fill that up. So, there was a scattering of BSD people around. So, after part, I said, first night was, you get a 2-hour movie, and then you're pretty much on your own. Said I went to Old Town and then sleep, and then there's an after party at a bar there. It's called Headshots, and it's a bar for nerds. It, you know, around the walls you have either coin op machines or console games running, and they're all free to play. And then you know, a variety of craft beer, and then you have tables, and then they have, you know, they have a bunch of tabletop games there. Murph and I introduced everybody to Jungle Speed, which he's always carrying with him. So if you need to come to a conference where Murph is and sit down and play some rounds of Jungle Speed with him. He'll beat you every time, but it's always fun. So, that was last weekend that I, you know, more, and this is the first year, you know, I said, Murph came, they got John Hall to come out, Kansas Linux Fest is coming into its own as far as attracting, people from outside the immediate state or the surrounding states. It's on its way to becoming a fest like OOF, in my opinion. Michael Lucas, he was up he's from the Detroit area. In fact, if I met him before, I would have probably, seen him at, PegaCon these last 3 years. So next year, next year when I at PegaCon, I'll have one more person to go hang around with. In fact, I'll need to look for him because I owe him $4. I bought one of his, on this fiction book I bought, I was 15 and I ended up 20 and could not, I come up with 11 and, he didn't have change. So it came down to that, heck with it. We'll give it to me when you see me. So I'll have to go, seek him out at, next PenguinCon. if you've listened to Podnuts in the last few weeks, Doors mentioned that he and Cody I'll think of him in a minute. Some people from Podnuts were going to come to Kansas Linux Fest. Until they found out that it was on Mother's Day, and they figured their mothers would skin him alive. Tracy Holtz, that's who else I was thinking of. I guess Dora's actually going to fly down to Texas, and he and Tracy were going to come up together. So, that was pretty much set until they saw what the date was. So we would have had a really big contingent, of the podcasting community there at Kansas Linux Fest, and maybe next year it'll work out. What I'm afraid of is it was both Mother's Day and I guess finals week. What I'm afraid of is I know that they said Linux Fest Northwest is going to move back to the last weekend in April rather than the first weekend in May. And usually it and PingCon are on the same weekend. Have been for quite a while, and just it was these last 2 years they haven't been, and they sort of switched weekends. But if they're moving, and then if Kansas Linux Fest is looking for an earlier weekend, I'm just afraid we'll find out next year they all three fall on the same weekend, and I'll have to make a choice. But hopefully, I'll be able to hit at least two of the three. So, yeah, okay, that's pretty much it on my long and wandering travels this past month. Okay, I did mention that in the raffle, I won an Acer Chromebook. I won't go into it too much, but there's some things I've learned in the last couple of weeks about setting up a Chromebook. If you want to go beyond the normal Chromebook functions. Of course, the first thing you have to do is set it in developer mode. And I did not put the instructions for that. I do have a link to the particular one I have. It's the Chromebook Flip with the M3 processor. So that's the mobile version of an i3 fanless, completely quiet, 64 gig of EEMC storage. I did get 256 gig SD card and put in it, and it sees that. First thing you might want to do is you can't do this on every Chromebook. You can on this one, and they enable the Play Store, and there links to that. And once you've got in developer mode, there is more than one channel that you can be getting your Chromebook, your Chrome OS updates from. And there's, I guess, the alpha channel, which is the standard one, beta channel, which is essentially testing, and and the third, well, let me open that. There's a third one that is essentially, almost essentially nightlies. So for most Chromebooks, some Chromebooks, you'll go in, and this is in the article, go into the setup menu and scroll right down. It'll have enable Play Store. On most of them though, if it is supported at all, it's going to be one of the other two channels. Let me scroll down here so I don't say it wrong. Yeah, there's a stable channel is the normal one. Developer channel. When I said developer channel is essentially your nightly. So your and I went straight to that because I was tired of messing with it. Probably what you ought to do is do developer channel first. And, or not developer channel, the beta channel first. To see if you can get it, because that's going to be more stable. I haven't had any trouble. If they're talking about developer channel, you're asking for stuff to crash. But you do that, and then go in settings, and then you do have a Play Store, and then you can, you know, there's sort of like a start button down on the lower right or lower left. Sorry, you click on that. And that'll give you things beyond just the browser, and Play Store is there. And from there, you know, since I've been having trouble with my Remix OS Ultra, you know, the Ultra tablet, I think I mentioned that before. Sometimes you turn it on, and for some reason, it doesn't recognize the Wi-Fi card, and it's got to where it's doing that pretty much all the time, which means it's essentially a brick. So I've been able to replace it with this Chromebook by installing apps from the Play Store. So I can do my Hulu, I can do my Netflix, I can do my HBO, all that stuff. So, and then of course everybody said, well, what about real Linux? So, you know, instead of overwriting the whole thing, just turning it into a regular Linux laptop, I have installed Crouton. So let's talk about that for a minute. I had to do a bunch of searching around to find a lot of this stuff. So this is just to make it easier for anybody picking up a Chromebook for the first time and wants to do things more than just stock. So I've linked the Lifehacker article. That's not the one I actually used. I wish I'd used it. I'm just pausing to open the link here. It's kind of weird. Even without developer, you can get to sort of a terminal window running in the browser. Okay, and this talks about going to developer mode. It's press and hold escape and refresh keys together, and then press the power button. Now reboot in recovery mode, and it'll reboot and warn you that it's in recovery mode and stay there, you hit Control D. And then every time you boot after that, unless you want to sit there and wait for several minutes for it to go on past that initial screen, you hit Control D. But it what's doing is asking you every time it boots, are you sure you don't want to put this back in the safe stock mode? No, without any of the extra stuff. And it's going to sit there long. It takes a long, long time to install developer mode. And it takes and when we get to it, it takes a long, long time to install Crouton, like about 40 minutes. So first thing you do is you download Crouton, and it'll go into a down. It actually goes into a downloads directory. Mine, for some reason, I have home and folder with this big long number, you know, gibberish character screen, and then downloads. So for if you get one of the Acers, you know, you're gonna have to modify the commands on one of these pages to your particular situation, because you just can't, you're not going to be able to copy and paste because the folders won't line up right. But you want to bring up terminal by hitting Control Alt T, and that actually just brings up a terminal in a browser window at the terminal, but you're still not really at a command prompt. Well, it's not even quote full Linux command prompt. You're not at a virtual terminal yet, but you type in the command shell, and then the next command on the page is to install Crouton. And like I said, if you're me and you had the Acer, it's not going to work, because there's a directory in between that you need to put in. But it's sudo space sh, and I've never used sh before. I assume that means run the target file as a shell script. Space dash e space, and then their path to where you download Crouton. That's what I had to modify. Also, I think what I had to do, well, the other tutorial has you, rather than sudo before the command, has you do sudo space su, and just put you in the root mode. And I'm thinking, yeah, it didn't, you know, just sudo did not work on Acer. You had to do sudo space su. But yeah, okay, start over again. The command is basically sh space dash e space path to the Crouton download space dash t space XFCE, comma touch, or the other way, it's in there. That the touch enables the touch screen interface. XFCE enables a a GUI interface for Crouton. And see, I didn't do that when the tutorial I showed did not even mention doing anything to put the GUI on. Whoever wrote it said, probably thought, oh, you'd never want anything on the command line. So if you want to install GUI interface, then it's dash T space name of the interface. And in fact, in my case, I think it was like XFCE4 that I had to execute. And you could have more than one. There's more than one GUI available. You could have Unity. Everybody says, I haven't tried Unity. Everybody says Unity chugs the machine. I don't know if that's for Intel as well as the ARM-based Chromebooks. Definitely probably you would not want it on an ARM-based Chromebook. So, you know, XFCE is one of the lightest ones. So that's probably the one I would recommend going with. I've also installed D17 on mine. I learned that was available. Most of these tutorials don't mention it. I think pretty much any desktop that's available on the Ubuntu. It because of course the underlying system is Ubuntu, is available under Crouton under Chrome. And again, that you anything you install, you there are every package you install is comma separated. So in my case, the Acer Flip is touchscreen enabled. So like, if you want the touchscreen, you also need to put that on there. It's in the show notes. If you've already got Crouton installed and you want to install it in different desktop or anything else, it's pretty much the same command, except at the end you add a dash U for update. Okay. And you start that and you walk away from the thing for 45 minutes. There's also an E flag for encryption. You can encrypt the entire desktop. I didn't do that. as far as actual use, there are dedicated left and right buttons for forward and back. So it's Control Alt forward to launch Crouton. Once I got the GUI interface on, I played with it a little. The browser is absolute. Well, it's meant to be a really lightweight browser they give you, but it's not useful for anything because it's so lightweight. You know, you can't do videos or anything like that in it. A lot of pages don't render well. In fact, just getting to my Gmail page, it says, "Sorry, we can't. You know, we can't do any Java here, so we have to jump you back to the, you know, the stripped down version of Google Mail." So I assume somewhere in there you can install Firefox. I haven't looked into that yet. Everything that I'm doing with the machine, you know, so far I've been able to do everything I need to with the browser or with the Android apps. But you know, I assume, you know, there's probably a lot of people like a nice little lightweight computer and occasionally need to get in some real apps. I mean, of course, last couple of weeks, every time need to get in a real app, I get on a real computer. But like I said, this has been a real good replacement for the Remix OS Ultra tablet. Not something I would have ever bought for myself. I mean, I've considered Chromebooks before, but only the cheaper ARM ones that are only a couple hundred bucks. This thing is over $400 new, so you know, dollar for a raffle ticket is a lot better price than that. And thanks very, very much to people from Linux Fest Northwest. This is the point where I actually take a breath and see if anybody has any comments, questions.
Well, just for, I think my friends at pluggable.com have accessories for Chromebooks, including Ethernet connectivity if your system doesn't have an Ethernet port and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that. I have bought accessories. The 256 gig SD card was north of $100, so of course you wouldn't need that much. You might not need any. I'm just, you know, I'm type of person. Well, what if it does, you know? And one of the things I want to find out is, can I mount this in such a way that you know, if there was any overflow from the root directory, you know, either from installing Android apps or from, you know, if I go into Crouton and start installing Firefox, and you know, if I want to install OpenOffice or something like that, is there a way to, you know, push that off on the card rather than, you know, the card just being storage for files, you know, for documents rather. Okay, a couple things I didn't mention. I was having some password problems once I got Crouton installed. It was asking for a password where it never set it. You go back into that browser-based shell, and you can run sudo chrome os dash develop set dev pass wd in the shell, not in Crouton, because as I said, I was locked out of Crouton without a password, and that will let you reset the user password in Crouton, and then you could do sudo in Crouton to get to where you can reset the root password. And if you're prompted, and you may be, but if you do the sudo chrome os set dev password in that browser based shell, you may be asked for a password. And if so, try test 0000. So it's test followed by four zeros. And I found that in a couple articles. That's not mentioned in every one of them. So again, it's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it. Give a little primer on getting started with doing add-ons to Chrome OS. So all that's in the show notes. You want to come back and refer to it. But yeah, first things I got was the SD card. The only interfaces are two USB-C ports, and your charger has plugged into one of them. And it can be either one. You can either plug it in on the left or the right, whichever. I did get some USB-C to USB-A adapters, so I could plug in other devices. And then I also ordered a USB-C mouse that hasn't gotten here yet, and a USB-C to HDMI adapter, which also has another. You know, you get ones that are just that, but a lot of a little bit more money also have an SD card adapter, a power pass through, in other words, another USB-C port, and you can plug the power into there, and so that you're not losing one of your two ports. Yeah, and I looked on Amazon for one with Ethernet. I thought I'd seen one, but I couldn't get back to it so they are there. I'll have to check that out. Thanks, Netminder, because that's probably something else. You know, obviously I'm one of these people, you know, I'm not willing to accept Chromebook at stock as it came out for, you know, purpose it was intended. It's like, if I don't use it, yeah, I want to have the power to run real Linux. I want to plug in the wired Ethernet. So, and to that end, I've spent, you know, well, it's mainly just the card, but the other accessories, you know, each in like the $20 range. So, yeah, get free laptop and then start spending money on it. okay. Again, I want to mention Michael Lewis's Amazon link, which was the next thing in the show notes. A lot of people benefit from getting one or more of his books. Okay, now I'm going to jump in a couple topics that I threw out last week on Tilts where I was a guest. One of them, I guess you guys that I talked about on Tilts last week was also mentioned here, which was the Google Cardboard, Google Home thing. So that you just add a Raspberry Pi 3 and have a home-built Google Home. So since that was mentioned, you won't need to hit it here again. Breaking for comments or questions.
By the way, I've seen an external SSD that uses USB 3C.
Oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
You know, yeah, I mean, this was. You could get. I think the ones at Micro Center, the low end one was like 120 gigs, but the only ones that they were actually selling were the 250s or.
And I will say this, you know, it's a very well built little computer. It's thin. It's got an aluminum case all around, but the back is removable, so you could actually get in there and work on something. You know, very light, almost as light as the Remix OS tablet, which is physically smaller. So, yeah, this is a neat piece of kit. Okay.
I'd really look at Pluggable if you're looking for accessories. They do USB in all sorts of strange and wonderful ways.
Nice. I'll look into that. Thanks, Netminer. A couple quick things we talked about on Tilts I want to talk about here. You know, you've got this new Windows S coming out, and the only way to install software on it is from the Play Store. So no third-party software, unless I guess they get themselves on the Play Store. No, you know, no download, no installing OpenOffice or, you know, any other sort of free software. No downloading stuff from download.com and putting it on there. And, you know, and really even, I talked to Chris Wade at LinuxFest Northwest. Even he thinks I'm paranoid on this. But you remember when he came around about 18 months ago, after the FCC had said, you know, made rules that say, you have to certify that nobody can install software on your browser that will make it transmit in an illegal fashion, and and most of the industry interpret that means, oh well, we've got to lock it down to OEM firmware because we don't know what somebody else might install. We can't control it. And it's a software-defined radio, so there's no way in hardware to control it. And Chris, who is the CEO of ThinkGeek, which produces Linux, well, produces computers with Linux pre-installed and 100% Linux compatible, he said, well, you know, if I've got a wireless card in something, especially like a laptop, I can't running open software. There's no way that I can say to the government, "Yes, I can certify that nobody could take this laptop and make it work in an illegal manner, broadcast on an illegal frequency." And if you weren't listening 18 months ago, this whole thing came up with. There was this place out in California the new 5 gigahertz standard. A couple of those channels overlap with radar Doppler radar at airports, or Doppler radar at airports. And you know, your OEM software or firmware setups, it listens for those channels if there's radar out there, and if there is, it disables those channels in the router. I mean, you still have other 5 gigahertz channels. You just lose a couple of them if you're right next to an airport. Some yahoos out in California were buying routers, flashing it with modified firmware that just ignored that. And these things came out on the market, and the FCC hit the ceiling and said, okay, yeah, we've got to lock down every radio that broadcast that has potential to broadcast this 5 gigahertz. And the only way to do that is to, well, they didn't care how you did it. They just told the manufacturers to do it. And there was a proposal for a similar regulation that would have applied to PCs. And, you know, software-defined radios, the only way a manufacturer could guarantee it is if they vetted every piece of software that would go on that computer. So essentially that would be the end of open source. Now at the time, of course, under Windows, of course, you had third-party software. You had, like I said, things that you might download off download.com, what we used to call shareware, you know, independent software. I mean, a lot of businesses have customized software that is written specifically for their business. So it's not like a major manufacturer like Adobe or Microsoft. And of course, you know, there would probably be a fee associated with vetting the software. So that would, you know, that would put most of your open source developers out. Chris had started this Save Wi-Fi campaign to get grassroots and tell the FCC, Ben, you are going to really foul us up if you do this. And, you know, after a few months, they backed off. They even backed off on the router. They said, no, we never intended to say you couldn't install DDWRT on your router. TP-Link was one of the manufacturers, like there's more than one, that did, at least for a while, lock their stuff down to OEM. And they had a lot of makery type radio stuff. They just they quit selling, you know, for because they couldn't be controlled like that. So it's not like they were a company that, you know, took this lightly. I mean, they were in the business of selling experimental and maker type stuff. Where I'm getting to with this Windows S, we said a year ago, well, even Windows, it would cut them off, you know, they'd have to lock Windows down to only stuff that had a certificate, which they don't. And now we've got this Windows S coming out, mainly intended for their Surface tablets. I think the S stands for either security or Surface. I would say it stands for something else. But Windows S will run on, you know, regular tower, Intel machine. So, and Windows 7 is supposed, or not Windows, Windows 10 is an upgrade from Windows S. So they are not at the time selling Windows S like this is the future. But this, what I've been getting at and ranting on is, does this look like Microsoft might be looking towards a future where, you know, computers are locked down, come with Windows S, and the only way you can get software is through Microsoft?
Well, it's actually ransomware.
Well, in a way, because to get on the Windows Store, you're going to have to pay money, I'm sure.
No. I mean, Windows S, if that comes the OEM version of Windows, one of the things that is available at the Windows Store for about $50 is an upgrade from S to Windows.
All right, yeah. and they will use things like WannaCry as saying, see, this is why you need this.
Actually, what somebody has said, and this seems reasonable, is that Microsoft can hand out cheap copies of Windows to schools and everybody, saying, hey, we have this super secure lockdown, only our stuff runs on it stuff. And anybody who wants to run their PC as a real computer, as we're used to, will have to pay a premium to unlock their machine.
Right, I see that. Now, the schools I've always worked for, they had all this third-party software. However, a lot of that stuff is moving to the web. So, you know, it was getting to the point where some of the stuff was so old and creaky that they had, it was getting to the point where it wasn't, you know, it's stuff they've been running for 10, 15 years that they were in love with, but getting more and more difficult to get it to run. But a lot of that stuff is, you know, a lot of those companies have probably seen this coming and moved to the web rather than being natively installed. So that may not be a problem. But when I was working for a school, that, you know, Windows S would be a non-starter because they had so much stuff. They had me installing on every machine that was just these little third-party one-off applications. All right, the other one I wanted to mention, this is coming to here, Great Britain recently passed a law that if you watch a pirated stream online, then you can go to jail for 10 years. So it has been, you know, if you torrented like a movie and you had the movie on your hard drive, like you had A Few Good Men sitting on your hard drive, you know, and they searched your hard drive and they found that, then yeah, you could get fined, go to jail, whatever, for theft. But, you know, we've been having these streaming torrents where you don't actually get the file, you just watch it as it's coming down. And whoever's seeding that torrent, yeah, they could get in trouble. But it's been a legal gray area. Of course, you never know until this is tested by case law. But, you know, the general consensus was, no, there is no law against watching that stuff being streamed. And of course, we've had in the last year a bunch of people putting Kodi on little Android TV boxes and then installing the plugin that lets you watch the illegal streams, which Kodi's not really happy with, but that's, I don't know what they thought most people were doing with their software, but they're not happy. The whole thing's being resold in a package, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, watch any content you want for free. And this is why this law has come up in Britain. I would not be surprised. You know, I think the current state of our administration and Congress is that they wouldn't hesitate at all to pass a similar law. So just want to give, you know, if there's anybody in Britain didn't know about this, you know, wanted to warn them. And then, you know, here, keep your heads up, because we're probably going to get something here, and then the party will be over for everybody, which is usually the way government works. And I'm sorry for just dominating things again. That's about everything I had this evening.
Here's something that actually is eventually going to be Linux related. There's a fella down in Connecticut who got himself a Z800 mainframe. It's the only Z800 mainframe, complete Z800 mainframe in private hands. I've been following him on YouTube. He plans to put Debian on it. This is IBM Big Iron.
Is he going to make it available for people to create accounts on it?
I would kind of doubt it. It is more part of... He's got a Sun super... mini supercomputer. He's got sort of a museum of random computer stuff. And this is just the cherry on the top, having a real mainframe. He's primarily using the Sun as a disk farm.
Well, keep us updated on that. And, let us know when
he's got some stuff, but evidently the big mainframes are dumb as a box of rocks. It's got a couple of ThinkPads that it basically uses for what we would consider BIOS functions. And then it has another PC which is used for sort of console stuff. But he's working on getting the magic, basically what autoexec.back or config sys from the bad old days for the IBM, to get it to look over to the Sun Super Mini and use that as its file store.
Well, it sounds like quite the project.
He weighed about 1,500 pounds, and he had the devil's own time getting it off the truck and into his basement garage.
Well, I remember back when I was in school, college got rid of, I think, a PDP-9 or a PDP-10. And if I'd been driving a pickup, I just had my car. Because nobody wanted it. They couldn't get rid of it. I would have brought that home, and it would, you know, I'd still have it out in the shop somewhere.
Actually, I've had the honor of seeing the original AI PDP-10 at MIT. At the old World War II temporary building, Building 20, which they tore down about the turn of the century. Pretty good lifespan for a temporary building.
Yeah, well, all that stuff was built, World War II was built cost plus, so it would, you know, usually most of it lasted pretty good.
Of course, it was asbestos shingles, and you go in there and the beams are 12 by 12 or some, you know. They didn't worry about materials. And all the wiring, even for the modern stuff, was cobbled into tuba knob mains. But, yeah, I wrote up that I'd seen some, the AI-10 had 360-era tape drives that attached to it. And they said that if you drop those tape drives off a truck, you've got a pothole. You drop deck tape drives off the truck, you'd have to sweep up the plastic.
Yeah, they built stuff back then. Well, Honky, you had some topics for us. Let's see, you must have stepped away.
Well, to give you an idea about this guy, he's going to upgrade his gigabit in-house network to 10 gig.
Well, you don't want to get up there on the bleeding edge of that fancy newfangled stuff.
Well, he just moved into a new place, which I guess he's going to have 2 gig up and down fiber. Yeah, well, and I thought I was doing good with gigabyte in the house and on my DSL.
Are you back yet, Honky?
Yep, sorry.
Yeah, I was just saying, you had some topics for us. I'm going to step away from just a second.
Okay. So, I don't know how I wound up finding this, but I started Googling around to ways to extend the life of the Nintendo DS, and I came up on with, might not have been this exact article, but probably a similar one that I put in the show notes, and it's where you get a you order a micro SDH adapter, which is basically because the the DS takes is it's like a almost like an SD card, you know. So it is an SD card. So, but you can buy ones that are set up for the R4DS, and R4DS is the program that it uses for this. And there are, I put in the list all sorts of applications that you can use on this R4DS. And the main one for me for doing this was emulators. It comes with at least the one I got came with an NES emulator pre-installed. And obviously I can play, it'll do DS. I downloaded a SNES emulator. So right now I went to archive.org and downloaded, found an archive of pretty much all the SNES games and all the NES games. So now I have all of those plus some, DS games on the one SD card, the micro SD card that I have. But also, if you look at the list of applications in the section, there is something called DS Linux. So one of the things you can throw on this is actually Linux. I've had a limited amount of time to actually play around with getting it to work. Most of the time since I've got the R4DS working, I have been spent playing around with old, you know, NES and SNES games, but I have, you know, I've looked into it, and I'm gonna try to get it running. I might have an update next week as to what I've gotten, if I've gotten it to work or not, and how it is. There is it's a very, very, very low power machine, so there's not a whole lot you can do with it. The thing that I thought was interesting was SSH, and I figured it'd be interesting to be able to turn it on and, you know, go into SSH. I had to go into a Linux, basically a Linux machine, and then go into use it for SSH type stuff. There is a desktop environment. Apparently, it is based on Pixel, or it is a version of Pixel, which is the desktop that Raspberry Pi went with. One more recent, Raspbian went with. DS Linux is not being maintained anymore, so, but I figure, like I said, it's more of just something to try, just because, doing something just because. Yeah, so, that's what I've been playing around with.
And hey, don't feel bad. I've bought hardware to just play around with just because.
Yeah.
Now, how do you use a keyboard or anything with the DS?
Well, like I said, I haven't gotten DS Linux up and running just yet. But there is a so it's with the DS, the bottom screen is a touchpad. So that was that's where the keyboard is, and then the top part would be like the monitor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right now I just keep playing. Like I said, on the 116 gig SD card, I do have basically every single NES and SNES game on there, plus some DS games. So I've been wasting most of my time playing those.
Well, don't feel too bad. Hearing, you know, saying you're just doing things just to do it, because hear you talk about this, I start thinking about, well, I wonder how much a DS is on eBay.
I don't know.
The one thing I'm looking at, on the way back from Wichita last week, I stopped at a Walmart, and what I was looking for was the Dancing Baby Groot, which I got, and fact, after getting home, I got another one, which is going to go up in the attic because I think someday, you know, I'm going to sell them on eBay before I paid for it. But they have some little tiny console, you know, miniature console games. And Q-Bert and the Space Invaders and Pac-Man and the Worm, I think, was the other one. But in any case, I got the Q-Bert console. Apparently, it's the only one of the four that's actually in color. The rest are all monochrome. But I don't want to tear it up, but I got home, looked at it, and that 3x5-inch screen that I've got on my, on my travel router would just fit in there if it was Dremeled out. And plenty of room in behind there for the Raspberry Pi. Then I was thinking the battery too, you know, and I said, well, hey, why don't I do a dual project, put my travel router in one of these cases, because the unit's only about $12, so it'd be worth it just to buy it for the case and tear it apart, and, you know, switch SD cards and, you know, have the main, not main, but the distro that runs the game emulators and all that. But it
RetroPie.
You know, RetroPie, yeah. You could make it where the HDMI port was available, so you know, yeah, you could take it, plug it into a TV instead of just playing on a tiny little screen. So that's a project I'm thinking of. Unfortunately, I have not seen that same game locally, so I may have to go out to another Walmart to find it.
That would be a cool idea. I've been thinking about, and I think I talked about it briefly last time on our show, was I have so many of these mini PCs sitting around, and I've been trying to think of... My goal is to try to put all of them to work for to do something. And one of the things I was thinking of is the chip computer. It has, I went looking around for different things to do, different projects that people have done with it. And one of them was making like a Bluetooth speaker out of it. Basically, you just basically hook speakers up to it, and because it's Bluetooth, has Bluetooth compatibility, or it has Bluetooth in it, or whatever. Connect to it via Bluetooth, and then broadcast whatever, you know, from your phone or what have you that way. So I was thinking about making a. But there is another project as well that was having it as like a light, and I got to think. And there's also a cool little connector here on the bottom that'll work for hooking up to a battery pack. And it almost looks like the same type of connector I have for some of my the batteries that are used for my little quadcopters. So. I'm wondering whether I can get some sort of a battery pack for it and set it up as a get like one of those like a USB LED light and then one of the speaker, because it's got a little audio jack on it. The problem is they put both the audio jack and the USB are right next to each other. I had found on Amazon a looks like a pretty nice speaker that just plugs straight into the audio jack with no wire or anything, just sits on it. And then one a USB LED light that did pretty much the same thing, but it was like a nice big size LED light. But I might be able to just get away with one of the ones that are kind of a stem to it, LED lights that have like a stem to it, and then like a row of the little LED lights. Apparently, people have had good luck with those on light. I figured, you know, have it have it be battery powered and, you know, dual purpose for any number of things. I mean, if it's battery power, then you can carry that thing around with you wherever you want to go. You can, I've thought about just setting it up in the kitchen and have it, you know, Bluetooth speaker when everything is fine. But if like the power goes out, using it as a, like an emergency lighting, something like that. But I don't know. I want to put that thing to work. It's a cool little thing, but I don't want to think of it as another desktop. I would like to put it to work to do something.
Yeah, that's the thing I always do is you know, I always treat them as a desktop, whereas that's not really what their intention. Their intention was, you know, to be an embedded device.
Yeah, and I just got to get that. You know, I like using them as like little servers and stuff, but I gotta change my mindset on some of this stuff, you know.
Well, I've got a box here back in the closet. Hopefully, I get to it this summer. Was it the Omega 2? You know, it's about the size as a Pi Zero, but you could, with the kits and stuff, you can get something you plug, you can plug it into a base and then have your USB and then, you know, have all your regular outputs. But the whole thing, you know, well, the kit that I got's got all the makery stuff, the breadboards and sensors and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and the documentation on doing projects is pretty good on it. So that's what I bought that for. To sometime I am going to sit down and teach myself how to do all this makery stuff.
Can I throw something out, gentlemen? There's a Australian guy on YouTube called Mick Make, and he does every week or two, he does a review of what's on the various Asian sales sites, Kickstarter, a lot of it is the chips and stuff for all kinds of sensing and hooking up to your Raspberry Pi or your whatever single board machines to do various things, from proximity detection, humidity, weather, whatever. There's a river of them.
Yeah, I'm just looking here, pluggable.com. What did you say his name was?
The channel I follow on YouTube is, it's called Mick Make. MICMAKE, I think. He's an Australian, and he regularly covers a lot of the single board maker stuff. You know, sensors, chipsets, interfaces, development kits, all kinds.
I'll definitely have to check that out. Okay, was that all our topics for the evening?
Yes, I believe it was.
Plus 10%.
Yeah, I think I talked enough for about 3 shows.
This is what happens when you go away.
You're just catching up.
So the next recording date is June 2nd, 2017. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. I want to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, email list server, and Delwyn for providing the mobile server we use. He also helped create the bot module that in our IRC channel, all I have to do is type .ns, and it'll show the next recording date. Well, I have been Honky Magoo. With me was 5150.
So long, folks.
And Netminer.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. That seemed like an odd thing to do.
Well, they say it's too hard to continue the non-crypto branch of the system. If you just use the
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Lionridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like the gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies at a Lincoln band.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.